This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Good morning. Welcome to the December 2nd, 2010 event, Realizing the Promise of Health Information Exchange. Have we turned the corner? Part of the Booz Allen Hamilton Expert Voices Distinguished Speakers Program Series, sponsored by the Health Market and the Cyber Campaign. It is my pleasure to introduce Timmy Leslie, Vice President of Booz Allen Hamilton.
Good morning. The value of securely sharing and storing and analyzing health information is very clear. However, our ability to confidently come together as a single community to do so is not. Today, we have brought together top leaders in the healthcare market to discuss those factors that are critical to advance health information exchange. This panel affords us a very honest and very clear dialogue between those of us, all of us, that have a stake in a successful health information exchange. I am personally very thrilled to welcome all of you, our panelists, and our guests here today. First of all, I'd like to introduce Lori Evans Bernstein, who is the president of GSI Health. She also was one of the first authors of our ONC strategic plan. She was also the New York State Health Information Coordinator, and also now as president of GSI Health that advances products and services for health information exchange. I also like to introduce Devin McGraw, who is the director of the Health Privacy Project, Center for Democracy and Technology. She also co-chairs our Privacy and Security Tiger Team for the federal government and also serves on several health IT and health information work groups. Also, we have Dr. Brian Jacobs, who is the Vice President and Chief Medical Information Officer of the Children's National Medical Center. He also oversees all of their health information exchange and electronic health record activities and serves on several regional health information organization boards. We also have here Kelly Cronin, who is a senior advisor for the Centers of Medicare and Medicaid Services and Department of Health and Human Services. And Kelly and Claudia, who I'll introduce next, have been at the heart of health information exchange from the very beginning. And Claudia Williams, the director of the State Health Information Exchange Programs for the Office of the National Coordinator, and previously she was at the Markle Foundation. So thank you. So let's first set the stage. Let's first initially define health information exchange as the electronic movement of health-related information among organizations according to nationally recognized standards, which means it's not proprietary. There's some standardization going on. And also, I'd like to note that at times we go back and forth with health information exchange as a noun or the governance of health information exchange, the organization that oversees health information exchange. But for today, let's really focus on the movement of health-related information from point A to unaffiliated point B in a secure, trustworthy, and confidential manner. I think we'd all agree that the topic of health information exchange is growing with increased attention and focus, and especially at the onset of our American Recovery Act and high tech. So, in order to get kicked off, my first question, I'm going to go around with each panelist and have them answer, what does health information mean to each of you? How would you define it? And recognizing that each of you has dedicated several years of your career to the advancing of health information exchange, describe why you're so passionate about it. Lori, let's start with you.
My definition of health information exchange is the free flow of information to achieve a patient-centered healthcare system. And overall, I'm very passionate about the topic because I think it gives us options to figure out how to pay for healthcare differently and how to deliver healthcare in a new way. And both of those things are critical to health reform. So health information exchange certainly is not a silver bullet by any stretch of the imagination, but I don't think we'll achieve our goals as it relates to health reform without it. And I think that's sort of an overall answer. And then I think the passion that drives me today and probably all of us today is the healthy debate that we need to have around how we do it. I think we all agree on why it's important. I don't think there's any more debate and discussion about that. And in fact, since 2001, since the Crossing the Quality Chasm IOM report talks so much about it, we have been furiously trying to figure out how to advance it. And so I think the how is really where we need to focus our efforts.
I think that coming from a consumer
based organization, we see exchange as really the key to the change that needs to happen in healthcare. It's not, I completely agree with Lori, it's not everything. It's not the sine qua non of health reform, but it is absolutely foundational. And it's hard to see that anything else can be accomplished without it. And so we are really enthusiastic supporters of it, even as we advocate for strong privacy and security protections. In our view, consumers really deserve to get two things out of this effort. One is the data flows that are going to improve their own treatment as well as improve healthcare quality overall. And secondly, that all of this gets done in a way that keeps information confidential and protects it from inappropriate use. So why I'm passionate about it is because I see the potential, and I'm as frustrated as everyone here with that at the state of a system that we spend so much money on and yet it achieves so little comparatively. And I think we're at the crossroads of a place where we can make a tremendous difference. But of course, the challenges to getting there are big.
Thank you, Devin. And Dr. Jacobs?
Well, Timmy, as you know, healthcare in the United States can be quite fragmented. And as a critical care physician, I'm oftentimes in receipt of patients who are very sick, who I have less than optimal information in which to make diagnostic decisions and treatment decisions there. And I think that's true in general around the country. Patient can become injured or ill, present to an urgent care center, get sent to an emergency department, admitted to the hospital, discharged eventually to their primary care physician again. And at every step of the way, those providers are oftentimes put in a position of having to make decisions with less than adequate information. And it's not that the information is not available. It's out there somewhere, but it's either been communicated to them orally, or it's written in some legible fashion on paper, or it's just simply absent there. That is one of the major sources of redundant laboratory testing, radiology testing, errors in medicine, overprescribing, and all of the sort of ills of healthcare that we see today that not only result in poor quality care, but oftentimes cost overruns as well. So what's passionate for me about electronic health records and health information exchange is the idea that ultimately the clinician will be able to be presented with full, comprehensive, intuitive, high quality information so that they can make rapid decisions about care delivery for that patient in front of them and not do a lot of this redundant testing and overprescribing and error-prone care. So that's at the individual level. The other thing that is very exciting about all of this is the idea that you can use health information exchange and electronic health record data to really understand condition-specific populations of patients. So if someone asked you today, what's going on with your obesity problem with children in the DC metro area, or your hypertension in your adult population in Virginia there, it's very difficult to figure out what is actually going on there. And so the beauty of the electronic health record, that digitization process and the aggregation and analysis of that data allows you really for the first time to understand those condition-specific populations, where there are some opportunities for improvement, and then certainly once you put in preventative and treatment interventions in those populations, then using that same data to follow the outcomes as well. So that's why it's exciting for me, and look forward to where we're going in healthcare reform and health IT in the near future.
Kelly?
I would wholeheartedly agree with all the other comments on the panelists so far. And I think similar to Lori, I've also viewed health information exchange as being sort of a critical enabler and really prerequisite to many types of new payments for healthcare that need to be further tested and evaluated, and hopefully over time the successful ones will be more widely implemented across public and private payers, which is really going to lead to not only improvement in ability to manage at a population level healthcare, but also try to achieve some improvements in care delivery on a more of a system-wide basis. And I think to complement, again, what was said before about population health management, there's really a unique opportunity to get the consumer more engaged, not only in their own care and be more informed about their care, but outside of the healthcare system, for them to have information about what they should do in the way of prevention and behavior modification and really empower them to take better care of their care outside the system. I think HIE has been long thought of as sort of the enabler to deliver system reform, but we really have an opportunity to make more broad impact across populations, in particular get to, you know, maybe some of the determinants of health and really have an impact on what happens outside the healthcare system.
And Claudia?
It's always good to go last. I agree with and embrace the vision of secure sharing of information between people who have it and people who need it to support a patient's care and engagement. And I think taking it down to maybe a slightly more concrete level, when we look at meaningful use and we look at what we need to enable to achieve that, things like sharing care summaries across transitions when I get discharged, that information flows with me to my PCP, that I can get access as a consumer to my own information in a timely way so that I can decide what kind of treatment I want. And the lab result that was ordered is there available in my doctor's office when I go get care and enables that physician to do planned care around chronic care. Very concrete, and can we even imagine the kinds of health outcomes we need? Reduce readmissions, reduce medication errors, reduced redundant testing, better chronic care. None of these is possible even without those very simple pieces of information being routinely electronically exchanged. So I think when we think about exchange, what makes me passionate is the idea that we could, in the space of this year or next, see measurable changes to those kinds of outcomes, because these elemental factors, these very basic pieces of information are routinely available to me as a patient and my physicians who are caring for me.
So the topic today is, have we turned the corner? And I think we all have that belief in what can be. You know, the next question that I think we should really take down at the very grassroots level is, are we there? Have we turned the corner? For those of us who are referred to it as the tipping point, you know, have we actually reached the tipping point of health information exchange? And, you know, I would reference the considerable investment that the federal government has made with over $1 billion in different programs for the ONC to advance health information exchange, in addition to the meaningful use incentives. You know, will that accelerate where we need to be, and have we actually made our mark? Kelly, let's start with you.
Well, I think we're clearly seeing more movement of health data across the system, and I think there's multiple surveys that have measured that over the last few years, American Hospital Association being one of them, and I think even some surveys of some hospital executives more recently have indicated that there's a real commitment to get more engaged with health information exchange. So whether or not we're at a tipping point, I think, is questionable, but clearly there's more providers willing and actually exchanging data across the system. I think that right now, Now we don't know if we're on a path to get to more of a patient-centric system where the information could be following the patient, you know, longitudinally no matter where they get care. And I think that part of the challenge with how we do this is sort of, how do we structure the market, or how do the incentives we're giving, how do a lot of the different levers that we have, policy levers and programs on a state and federal level, how can that enable a really productive market that's going to eventually meet the consumer needs in a cost-effective way, a cost-efficient way. So I think it's clear that the investments so far from the federal government and the state governments have really put this on the map, and that there's a real, you know, need to continue this, and perhaps in stage two and stage three meaningful use regulations, there's going to be more clarity around what's going to be required for health information exchange. Clearly, it's going to be need to be more robust and really be more of a patient-centric type of exchange, not just going from two providers that know each other and perhaps have the same system that's interoperable. So I think we have a lot of tools in our toolbox right now to get us there, and, you know, we just need to really be talking and working together about how best to utilize all those tools to get us to widespread adoption.
Thank you. And Dr. Jacobs, I know as a hospital executive, you're in these conversations on a daily basis. What are you seeing?
This has actually been a great year for HIE, I think, not only with the high-tech infusion of cash, but if you look just at the numbers here, we have over 200 active health information exchanges in this country. We have, if you look at operational health and information exchanges where there's actual exchange of data, just in the last year, we've gone from 57 to 73. Over 33 states, I think, have two or more health information exchanges. Nonetheless, I don't think that we've reached the tipping point, because I think there remains considerable challenges, particularly around interoperability, the integration of the data into the workflow of the clinician, the long-term sustainability. How do we sustain this after the cash dries? And some of the issues around standards, and just simply physician and non-physician adoption of electronic health records here. We're not doing very well with that in comparison to some other countries there. And if the electronic health record provides the data flow to the health information exchange, which I clearly think it does, if you don't have good adoption, the health information exchange starts to fall on its face a little bit. So I don't think we're at the tipping point, but nonetheless, I think it's been a great year so far.
Claudia, as you are overseeing many of these programs, are you seeing that type of uptake? Have we turned the corner?
I want to talk about three things. One, how would we measure the performance and achievement of that goal? Second, how do we enable innovation in this market? And third, how do we increase what I think of as information demand? So first, it's interesting, the kinds of things we're most interested in looking at are the flow, the act, the verb. So is e-prescribing occurring? Are pharmacies hooked up to e-prescribe? Are labs sending results electronically? Are docs integrating those into their EHS? It sounds very tactical, but when you start looking at things in that way, you can see that the noun HIE can rapidly enable that, but that there are many ways to sort of peel the onion. So one way would be that a Medicaid program could say from now on, we ain't paying for any lab results unless they're sent electronically. Or you could say to the doc, this is part of meaningful use, or you could invest in the HIE as announced. So I think if we really truly drive to the kinds of outcomes and performance metrics we want to see, how many patients have gotten electronic access to their data and in what timeliness, we can then get to the innovation, which is to say, I think we're going to see disruptive and exciting new models of how we're exchanging. We're starting to see that already in terms of the layers of the platform that different people are providing, both in private sector and public sector environments. I think we may be in a kind of Clay Christensen kind of mode where we're going to start seeing people solving very concrete problems like identity assurance and offering that as a platform to the market. So when we start to look at things in an outcome way, and then we think very strategically from the government, our job is not to innovate. Our job is to figure out how to enable innovation. And third, it is to make sure, by golly, that there is demand for information. That is the business case for HIE. So meaningful use was a first shot at that. We said you must do these things. But frankly, health reform is what's really going to drive every participant to say, I cannot do what I need to do without the information being available. I believe that the real tipping point is when the information demand goes from 20% to 80%, and the technology and the governance and the policy will follow that demand, I do believe. So I think we need to build on meaningful use. We need to figure out what's needed for medical homes and ACOs, but it's that increased business case for information sharing that in the end is going to really tip us over, I believe.
And Devin, actually, on that last point, will we go to the tipping point and then policy will follow? You know, let's comment on that.
I'm not sure I necessarily agree that that's the right order, but I'm in agreement that we're not at the tipping point. Serving on the Health IT Policy Committee, when we initially came up with the first set of meaningful use criteria, they were much more robust. There were many other elements of required exchange in order to be meaningfully using, and we heard loudly and clearly from the provider community that we had ratcheted it up too high to be done in years one and two. And ideally, you know, this is a voluntary program, at least at this stage of the program. So if you do set that bar too high, then and nobody comes to the party, you're going to have a big problem. On the other hand, we sort of feel like we're not exactly where we ideally would like to be in the initial years of a program where the highest amount of stimulus dollars are on the table. So now we're at the phase where we know that exchange is the ball game. I think everybody has known that all along. So what can you then do to sort of push that envelope with the dollars on the table as an extra financial incentive? Because I do think that the provider community, once this is part of, I don't want to present this as something that we have to push people who are resistant to doing this. I actually think that's not the case at all. But having said that, creating a financial incentive environment that will help drive the market innovation and, quite frankly, will help stimulate demand. So rather than having demand stimulate policies, I think there are a few things that we can do and need to do on the front end with the tools that we have in the toolbox, I like Kelly's analogy, in order to push that along a little bit. And not just on the health IT front. I mean, I think that some of the stuff going on in healthcare reform with respect to payment reform and formation of accountable care organizations and looking at outcomes and achieving good outcomes, you have to share data in order for that to happen. And the building blocks have to be in place for that to occur.
And Lori, what other challenges have you seen? Or I guess, first of all, have we met the tipping point? And if we have or have not, what are those challenges?
So maybe I'll go into answer three as part of answer two. Yeah, okay, great. So just to start with two, I think we're all in wild agreement that we have not reached the tipping point or we have not turned the corner. And I don't think we've turned the corner because we don't have the payment and regulatory policy, and nor the funding, despite high tech to do it. And I think one of the challenges, and it gets to Claudia's point relative to the business case, is that we're never going to have a business case unless we fix the market failure. And it is the government's job, in my view, to correct the market failure. HIE, you can't share data by yourself, right? The societal benefits, the public health benefits are far greater than any one stakeholder's private benefit. It's a classic market externality, and the government has a role in stepping up to fix that problem. And I think that there are lots of ways that we can think about doing that. I don't think we've done that yet. I think that's one of the most significant challenges we face. I think that if we start to link meaningful use and health information exchange in later phases in a significant way with all the noun components, the policy and the governments, we will progress.
Right. We'll get
Thank
there.
You.
We might have this panel again next year as well. So looking at, you know, bringing it down again to that ground level, what's worked? You know, there are several examples across the country of robust health, and I use that word, robust health information exchange, of having that ubiquitous access for information and having that information integrated into the electronic health records. I'm going to look to both Claudia and Kelly, who have overseen many of these programs and have studied at length of, you know, those factors. What correlations have you seen that are successful in health information exchange? Claudia, you want to start?
A couple things. I think first to recognize that, you know, we've used the escalator analogy probably exhaustively for meaningful use, and probably Devin's seen those various slides about 2 million times. Mm-hmm. But I think we need to recognize that there is a learning curve and an adoption curve also for exchange. And so one of the reasons the Stage 1 Meaningful Use did focus on very concrete things that could be enabled through me sending something to you is because of the hypothesis that builds upon existing exchange patterns that may be on paper and actually enables an increased level of trust, increased information liquidity in the system, which will build support and motivation to tackle what I think are more challenging questions around robust query models. So I think we need to recognize that there is an adoption path. I don't know that there's one. I certainly don't think there's one. I think for some communities, they will have the capability and motivation and stick with itness to figure out how to move more rapidly towards more robust models, which might be things like longitudinal patient records, query models to aggregation things so that you can look at quality and analytics and so forth. But I think we do need to recognize that without greater data liquidity and without greater use and sort of engagement around information sharing, it's going to be hard when you ask a hospital, for instance, to create an edge repository of its records that people can query. When you haven't even been sharing information with the other hospital, that's going to be a bigger jump. But that then relates to the importance of directly and transparently and in a very publicly engaged way, tackling the governance questions around who gets to use the data. And I look at it, you know, it's the basic fair information practice kinds of things. What kind of data do we want to collect and why? How do we get to use it? Who gets to use it? How do we have mechanisms to be sure that those rules are being followed? That is tough work. And it often takes a while to work through it. So I think one success factor we're seeing is an explicit phasing where we say, we're starting here. We're going to start with perhaps a thin layer of exchange. We're going to focus on Stage 1 meaningful use. We are building towards something else that we want to have in 2 years. And here's the hard governance work we're doing in the meantime.
And Kelly?
I think if you look over the last 10 years or so, what's worked in sort of communities that have embraced health information exchange as a priority for their population health goals or their healthcare system goals, they have had a sort of unique commitment across their stakeholders to get together and make it work. And I think some communities that have been particularly successful over time have had other complementary programs that have sort of, you know, had been sort of the engine to the value base to all this. So if they have a certain number of medical homes or primary care providers that are trying to coordinate care for their patients, you know, across the system, there's an obvious need to have health information exchange across the partners or the team of clinicians that are outside of that primary care home. If there are pay-for-performance initiatives going on in in that community. Then there's an obvious need to measure performance, and doing that in a more automated way where you have the ability to aggregate data to get to the measures that you're looking at for performance or payment, then that there's obvious need to have health information exchange. It reinforces it. So I think that the more that we line up all of the initiatives that are going to be part of health reform and make that applicable on a community level, I think we're going to be able to sort of replicate those success factors that really do provide the sustainable business case over time.
So, Dr. Jacobs, in your experience in the health information exchange organizations that you're working with, are you seeing the discussion around governance and how data use? Are those conversations, are they taking place, and are they a successful outcome?
My familiarity is mostly with the health information exchanges in D.C. and Maryland, and in both cases, they've taken the position of significant clinician engagement here. And I think this is an important success factor here. When you're thinking about success, it's very important to sort of define who you're talking about from a stakeholder. So the success for an individual provider providing one-on-one care or population care for their practice may be very different than the success for somebody who's looking at population health or public health or disease surveillance there. So I'll speak mostly from the provider point of view there. It's really important that when you're constructing the health information exchange that you derive that value proposition from that stakeholder that's going to be using it. In the case of the provider, what most health information exchanges in this region are doing are engaging panels of clinician excellence to sort of say, what data do I want? How do I want it? How are we going to integrate it? How do we ensure the accuracy, reliability, integrity, security, privacy of that data there? How are we going to do this best to engage myself and my other colleagues in the use of this data there? So clearly, clinician engagement in the design and the functionality of the health information exchange is important to success, and that's why a health information exchange, state-run or otherwise, who is not engaging their clinicians is probably not in the right place.
So actually, let's take that over to Lori. Lori, as your role of the state of the New York State Health Information Coordinator, how did you engage at the provider level, and what were some of the strategies that you deployed?
Great question. Let me clear the cobwebs. It was a couple years ago. We really took, I guess at a high level, we took the approach that we needed to strike the balance between bottom up and top down, and that's hard to do. And essentially, and we also sort of didn't know enough or feel enough to have sort of a cookie cutter approach, because there are lots of ways to do this. And we sort of did two things. We had sort of a state level organization, we had regional organizations, and then we had health systems that wanted to do things on their own, which was great. No problem. But the key to that is that, okay, you can be a health system, you can be a region, you can be, you know, sort of state level, but there has to be a set of policy guidance that everybody agrees to follow. And so we used our deeming authority as a state government. The federal government has deeming authority as well. And we started a collaboration process getting to, again, the top down and the bottom up, the deeming authority being more of the top down, the collaboration with the bottom up, and we convened, the folks on the ground. We convened the different projects that were receiving a lot of the funding we were giving out, and had a big tent, so even if you didn't receive funding, you could participate in this process, and we drove a set of, technical policies and protocols, privacy and security, consumer engagement, a set of clinical use cases and things like that, and through that governance process, we, started to work through a set of policy guidance, and then whoever you were, whether you were the health system or the region or whoever, you, if you received funding, you needed to comply with that guidance. And, it's It's not easy. I mean, it's hard to do, but that was really the essence of the framework that we put in place.
So taking that theme of states and how states are working through the policies and also some legislative changes, Devin, I know you've been involved in several states and discussing with them on how they're going to go about a legislative scan and then also thinking about making some bold changes. Can you give us a sense of, you know, those that have done well? Are there some model legislation out there that we should be looking at?
Yeah, I'm not aware of model legislation, but it isn't, yeah, no, I know. I got a call like 2 years ago from the model legislator people, the people who write those things, and it just kind of disappeared. I mean, there's just not really that much. I think there's interest in finding common solutions, but maybe we haven't hit the tipping point on that one yet either. There's a lot of activity going on in the states, a tremendous amount of activity, and it's very encouraging because where there's infrastructure development going on, which is sort of reverting back to exchange now as a noun, not necessarily a verb, but in the infrastructure development, the states that I'm aware of are doing the same thing that Lori spoke to in New York, pulling multi-stakeholder groups, pulling groups together so they have a multi-stakeholder initiative, pounding through the hard issues, deciding what are the terms and conditions under which people can participate in this, which is different than saying, I mean, we have privacy law, right? But that tells you what you can and can't do. It doesn't say, it's the outer guardrails of what's permissible. It says absolutely nothing about what you will do as a matter of practice. Who will you share data with? Who and what are the terms and conditions under which those data, who can get it and for what purposes can they get it? And then what are the rules that govern them once they have it? How long can they keep it? So they're complicated and they're not in the law. They're not in the law. The law just tells you what you're allowed to do. And the states and the regions and some local areas that are building this infrastructure are taking the time to pound through those very difficult issues and coming up with sets of policies that then the participants have to ascribe to or they can't play in the game. I think, though, that because those conversations take place as part of that infrastructure building exercise, since we know that not everyone will use a formal noun exchange, but we want everyone exchanging, what's less clear is how you get at the entities that might exchange directly, not through a formal infrastructure, beyond, again, setting those sort of policies and practices that you want to see put in place to build the public trust that is really the foundation for being able to move this forward. How do you do that? And I think we're still struggling with that a little bit, at least in the advisory committee work groups that I sit on. It's sort of, we have a struggle just to come up with what we think are the right best practices. Then you get to the point of, well, how do we hold people accountable for these? What are the policy levers? Can we use meaningful use? Does that lay too much of a heavy hand on the scale because the non-meaningful users aren't going to have to comply with it? And if we make it too hefty, these are the things that we're working through. I think there's much progress being made, but it's not necessarily universal yet.
Yes, Claudia. I would agree with Devin because I know these conversations are happening, at least just in our little very intense world of these work groups, in our governance work group and the privacy and security tiger team, even in our discussions about provider directories. And I guess one thing that I can say from a government perspective is I think what we're trying to do is be very thoughtful about what levers. One question is, what is your rights and authorities? But that's a different question from what's the best way to create the right ecosystem? So we could establish with lawyers that we have an authority that may make no sense to use. But what we're really driving towards is an ecosystem with virtuous cycles where your neighbor who wants information is reinforcing the right rules, where your contracts are reinforcing the rules, and where more explicit government intervention, whether through meaningful use or through licensing or through participation in the Nationwide Health Information Network is doing the same things. And I think we all have an obligation to think about how those various things, A, what do we want, and B, how do those things reinforce each other. It is possible that a unitary government action is the best case in some domains. I think in a lot of others, we're going to see this more textured environment where we agree on where we want to go, and we're using a lot of different levers to get there.
So I'm going to just change the conversation a little bit and move it into the health reform discussion, which we all are bringing up into our discussion. And I think it's just, it's giving us that possibility of having an additional framework for us to advance health information exchange and the Affordable Care Act, as well as changes that private payers are making today are giving at least some legs, again, of a framework for us to think about exchanging that health information. We also, when I mentioned the payers, we've had bundled payment methodologies that are going to be put in place, accountable care organizations that'll be sharing sharing cost savings across a broad population. And it just seems that health information is that framework, or that there's almost a precedent that we have to have health information exchange in order to, a prerequisite rather, in order to be able to move forward. So I'm just going to go around with a few questions. Kelly and Claudia, to start with you, how should organizations begin to think about how they're going to use or utilize health information exchange as they start preparing for health reform? How should they think about the data? Kelly?
It's a great question. I think that there's a lot of physicians and hospitals now that are interested and intrigued and perhaps even somewhat confused about what accountable care organizations might be and what opportunity that brings them. But there's no doubt that there's a lot of interest, and perhaps many providers are thinking about how they're going to organize themselves to be one. And with that example, I think that it's clear in much of the published literature and just discussion around ACOs that if you're going to coordinate care and manage at a population level your diabetics or your cardiovascular disease populations, whatever the population that you really think is in need of real intense care coordination and close follow-up, you really do need to have the information available across the system. So it can't just be electronic health records in the primary care physician's office that might be connected to one hospital platform. It has to be something that's going to work across the spectrum of care, because even in an ACO model where perhaps there is a common EHR platform across many of the providers within a network, there's inevitably going to be some clinical leakage where a given group of patients that are assigned to an ACO, they will most likely receive care outside of that network of providers within one ACO, particularly if there's competitive ACOs in a given market. So I think that it's in the provider's best interest to manage those patients and really do service to them to really understand the spectrum of care that they're receiving and know when they get admitted to the hospital and have that information immediately available so they can do the appropriate follow-up, even if that hospital is not affiliated with their ACO. So I think that there is going to be a need to sort of think specifically about the information needs depending on what type of reform activity they want to get involved with. So accountable care is one situation. Taking on medical home maybe as a starting point before they're going to be ACOs. There's clear information needs to coordinate care across primary specialty care, hospital care, skilled nursing facilities that again create sort of a similar need for continuity and information sharing. A variety of other payment related pilots and demos that will be going on, as you mentioned, Timmy, bundled payments being one of them. There could be, higher levels of capitation in other markets that have already been doing bundled care well and episodes of care well and know that. They're willing to go to more of a capitated model that really creates the risk that even, solidifies the need to have a much more connected system. So I think almost every opportunity you look at with delivery reform really creates the need. It's a matter of the community and the providers within that community to decide how they're going to get themselves organized to meet the set of activities that they want to take on over a given time frame.
And Claudia, are the pilots and the projects that are called out in the Affordable Care Act, I keep saying accountable, ACO, are those going to be enough, or do we need to do more?
It's the thing that I find most exciting, and we are sort of looking to our beacon communities as the early alert system to innovation and what's going to be exciting in this market. And I think, to me, it's the idea of co-innovating the information sharing with the care delivery changes. So when we look at some of the most effective interventions that have occurred within systems of care, and I think we all know about Kaiser and Geisinger and all of them. So one of them was something called the cardiac collaborative care model in Colorado that Kaiser had. And basically what it said is when you have a cardiac event, we have a series of information sharing tasks and very explicit responsibilities when you're When you're admitted, we talk to you about risk reduction. When you move to rehab, information goes with you that around your specific rehab goals. And when you move into the community, you move into a collaborative relationship with your pharmacist around your medication management. And it's a very explicit set of engagements and very patient engaged kind of thing. But you can see that if you're not saying to someone, it's your responsibility to act on this information when you get it and to work with the patient around it, we could have all kinds of information available and nobody would use it. So what's exciting to me about ACOs and medical homes is the opportunity to create a specific responsibility around care coordination and around specific jobs and tasks that I need to do to share it, to make sure the next person and the patient is engaged and knows what they're doing, and to have a way to measure our outcomes against that. Are we improving hypertension control? Have we reduced mortality, as Kaiser did, by 76% in Colorado for cardiac events? So to me, it's combining a clear goal with care delivery innovation and the information exchange. It's going to be really exciting.
Lori, how do you think that the new reform guidelines are going to really impact the success of health information exchange? Are we going to have a new world order?
I don't think we know yet. I think Kelly was just suggesting we don't know what an ACO is yet. We have lots of ideas, and they're very exciting ideas, because to Claudia's point, it really links together everything that needs to be linked to realize all the hope we have for health reform, right? It marries the information infrastructure with payment, with delivery, with patient engagement, and sort of population accountability. So it's terribly exciting, but I think as it relates to health information exchange, they're sort of apples and oranges a little bit. I think that, and since we don't really know what an ACO is yet, we shouldn't hold up the progress we need to make on health information exchange. It's almost, because it's so foundational, actually, to a lot of those ACO things. So, and I think the capacities are really different. I think that, ACOs are going to be clinical and sort of financial organizations in the sense that they're at risk for performance. HIEs are addressing sort of technical, sort of policy and protocol issues, and ensuring that health information grows up in the public's interest. I just think they're apples and oranges. But with that said, I think that a lot of existing health information organizations can become or be the ACO, but because they have all their stakeholders around the table. I mean, Buffalo is a great example, the Western New York Healthy Link. They have every single provider at the table. They have lots of patients. And so for them, they have an existing forum where they can start to have a lot of the ACO conversation. So I do think that, that's a nice synergy and will allow for some efficiencies. But I do still, overall see this apples and oranges.
And Dr. Jacobs, as you are preparing, or your organizations are preparing to participate in health reform, have you seen any changes to your health information exchange or IT strategy, or are you still staying course?
Well, we're like most organizations. Medicine has a very rich history of individualism and variance. And that's why, the greatest evidence-based care takes over a decade to get into mainstream medicine here. But on the other hand, I think we have a lot of models over, a couple of decades, really, of bringing evidence-based care delivery into the mainstream of the medicine of that organization rapidly. Call it ACO or medical home or whatever the term du jour is, that's been going on for a long time. It's just not part of mainstream medicine here. So the key really is the culture change and the movement in that direction there. Both ACO and medical home thrive best in a data-rich environment. And that's why electronic health records and health information exchange are really such key, if not essential, elements to moving in that direction there. What we find in our organizations, and others do as well, is that physicians and teams of caretakers don't necessarily embrace the individualism and the variance. And in fact, when the data is displayed to them in an intuitive, easy-to-read fashion about how they vary from their peers, they oftentimes get in line just simply based on the fact that they're different, without any incentives whatsoever. I give you a great example in our in an organization I was involved with over the last 10 years. There were several spine surgeons in the organization who had tremendous variability in their outcomes, length of stay, cost of care, morbidity, surgical site infections, and so forth. Simply getting that data together, displaying it to them, putting them in the room and closing the door, reduced the variance and brought evidence-based care to that practice there. So it doesn't have to be fancy. I don't think it's rocket science. Every condition has its own sort of small cadre of preventive care, diagnostic decision support, pharmaceutical and non-pharmaceutical treatments that need to be attended to in a data-rich way. That data needs to be disseminated. There needs to be a little bit of an incentive, and things will come along here. I think the kick in the pants now that we're seeing around a lot of the Affordable Care Act initiatives, ACO and Medical Home in particular, is it brings some formality to that and some incentive to that and some interest in culture change that I think will help us rapidly move along this timeline.
Let's now move forward another 5 years from now. When we hopefully have achieved stage three of meaningful use, when every American, if we achieve our goal, will have an electronic health record by 2014, I think. So that's a little less than 5 years. Let's move into that place. And I'm just going to go around and ask each of you to help to briefly close this as what and how will we interact with our system differently? And I'll have each of you wear a different hat. So starting with you, Claudia, how do you think the federal government will continue to steward and incent innovation?
So I think one area in which we have seen and will continue to see rapid progress is the sort of Tim O'Reilly conception of government as platform. And what does that mean? That's a fancy thought, but what does it really mean? I think it means taking on, and especially for standards and interoperability, but equally for some of the policy issues, the hardest, most core issues that are the foundation that others can build on. So the direct project that we took on was an example where secure transport. Let's tackle that. Let's figure out if there can be market adoption for a common standard. It's a domain in which people were already doing it. It's not like we're creating something from whole cloth. I think when you look at Devin's hard work on the Tiger team, tackling the question of what should our expectation be around consumer choice? So I think when we think about our role, I think we're trying to be very careful not to take on the world. Our job is not to build an EHR. Our job is not to be the innovator. Our job is not to even build the exchanges. We've paid for states to do that. But to say, what are the problems we can resolve here at the federal level that would make everyone's life so much easier? But I will tell you, there's going to be now we're having a debate right now around provider directories. Is that something that should be solved centrally or not? I don't know if there's always an easy answer to those questions. I also think we need to be very threaded and clear and thoughtful about how all the different policy decisions that we might have, from payment and licensing to meaningful use to health reform to even just saying, join us in hands, this is what we're going to do, the leadership and convening, how we can use all of that to point in the direction of a problem that needs joint solving and to help folks come together to solve it. So again, direct is an interesting example. We did not write a single line of code, but I think we were helpful in saying, here's a problem that people have been grappling with, and let's see if we can solve it together.
And Kelly, let's have you wear the consumer hat. How is the consumer experience differ?
Well, it's my hope that over the next many years, if I'm living in this area still, I think, you know, whether I'm going to a Georgetown or a GW facility, and I've been to both over the last 10 years and have records in both, that they can know what my mammograms look like. They know what my clinically relevant labs are. They know about the history of my, you know, two pregnancies and anything else that's relevant to my care. And right now, there's really not a likelihood that the Georgetown system and the GW system are going to, you know, be able to figure out how they're going to have a ability to share information. So I think that's sort of a concrete example of how I'd like to see in the next 5+ years the ability to, in my own community, to be able to access care where my records are readily available. And probably even more importantly, as a mom of two little ones who've been to the pediatrician a lot in the last 2 years, I'd like to have a longitudinal record for them. And they're actually with the children's facilities. and they're very IT savvy. They have great EHR, but there's no ability to share that information with the parents. So managing their care over time and being a good steward of their care, I think parents inevitably play an important role, whether they're sick or healthy. And for my father, who lives in Pennsylvania, who's a Medicare beneficiary with multiple comorbidities and accessing an awful lot of care in the last few years, I'm better able to support him and be a resource for him, although he's quite an effective patient advocate. If I can know what's going on with the neurologist at Jeff, and I know his PCP in Doylestown has the right information, and right now they have absolutely no ability to share information with each other. So I just would like a system that works better for my friends and my family and my community.
And I'm going to jump over to Lori, who I'm going to ask you to wear a payer hat. And how do you think payers' interaction with the system will change?
I think payers are going to become and should become insurance carriers. And those that pay for care aren't going to be involved in clinical medicine. And health, as you know, health information exchange supports informing doctors and patients, not payers. I think it's as simple as that.
And I'm going to end with Dr. Jacobs, so let's move over to Devin. Devin, what key state and federal policies will be in place?
Okay, so this is the optimistic
this is the
view,
optimal.
Right? Okay, so we have a pathway forward on the complicated privacy and security issues. Not necessarily one law, but a sort of common set of practices, whether it's a best practices regime that sits on top of law, but some policies that settle some of the most difficult questions that are causing obstacles, whether it's in the states, whether it's to NHIN Direct, whatever is the question, that we have sort of have the courage to choose. Which is, you know, you have to have the courage to choose. There are always going to be people, and especially among privacy advocates, and, you know, they're my brethren, but I deal with them every day, and we disagree about things. You have to choose. And you have to choose the path forward that allows for the data liquidity in a confidential way. And so it is my hope that we actually get the courage to choose and that we create a more stable and certain policy environment that will allow this to go forward.
Wonderful. And Dr. Jacobs, to wrap this up, how will the providers' day-to-day change, you know, advancing after stage three?
Well, I think we have the two biggest challenges we have here are physician adoption and then integration and value, integration into the workflow and value there. We're not doing well with adoption. Unlike our colleagues in the Netherlands and in New Zealand, where there's almost 100% adoption there, we still have 3/4 or more of our ambulatory physicians who have not adopted electronic health records there. So one of the things I'm looking forward to seeing with incentives and just time and culture change is that adoption there. If we don't see that, we're not going to get the value that we want to see in healthcare reform. And the second thing is we can build the greatest health information exchange in the world, but that doesn't mean that the clinicians are going to consume that information. It's got to be integrated into their workflow, and it has to have value there. So if I am taking care of you in my electronic health record, and right there pops up out of the health information exchange the medicines that you're actively taking, that's of value to me. If I have to go to another system and log in and see a laundry list of what you've been prescribed for 10 years, that's not of value to me. So making something intuitive and accurate, reliable, free of clutter, and integrated into their workflow is something I work for every single day, and one thing that we really have to strive for if we're going to make significant progress here for the providers.
What a great way to end. So I'd like to thank our distinguished panelists for their contributions on this very intriguing, and we could, I think, go for quite some time with this discussion. Today's Expert Voices panel, Realizing the Promises of Health Information Exchange, Have We Turned the Corner? I think we answered we have not. Featuring Lori Evans-Bernstein, Kelly Cronin, Dr. Brian Jacobs, Devin McGraw, and Claudia Williams. This Expert Voices panel was brought to you by Booz Allen Hamilton and Federal News Radio.
I encourage you to listen to this panel on demand, watch video from the panel, and read expert commentary on this topic at www.boozallen.com/expertvoices. This is Timmy Leslie, Vice President of Booz Allen Hamilton, and thank you for listening. Thank you.
This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program. FederalNewsRadio.com, your one-stop shop for all things federal. Listen daily to interviews with federal managers and government contractors. Read Mike Causey's daily federal report, or just stop by for an update on the latest news affecting the federal community. FederalNewsRadio.com, your source for federal news now.